This is the Cannabis Podcast with Martin Jonesy and Legalise Cannabis Victoria MP, David Edishak.
So, welcome to the Cannabis Podcast. I'm Martin Lane, the co-founder of Cannabis, and joining me today is Legalise Cannabis Victoria MP, David Edishak. David, welcome.
Thank you, Martin. It's nice to be with you.
And it's just you and me today, I'm afraid, as our chief correspondent, Steve Jones, is busy working on his latest scoop, or so he tells me. And I've actually stolen his office for the purposes of the podcast, so he better be out working. Okay. We chatted just when we were off air, just briefly about Mardi Gras. You're obviously there over the weekend. And I think one of the things you did while you were there was with your fellow Legalised Cannabis New South Wales MP, Jeremy Buckingham, did a session on the challenges of working with Labour governments. For those who weren't there, what did you say?
I probably can't in this medium be quite as candid as I was up at Nimbin.
Understood.
But I guess we've got very parallel situations in New South Wales and Victoria, given a lot of the work that was done previously in Victoria, particularly by Fiona Patten. We're probably 6 to 12 months ahead of where Jeremy's at in New South Wales. We're both experiencing similar resistance from the governments. It's a very challenging sort of problem to deal with because it's almost like an episode out of Utopia or Yes Minister, in that when you talk to ministers and to backbenchers in the government, you know, they're all, oh yes, absolutely, you know, I'm pro legalization, or I'm pro decriminalization, and I'm pro-reform. So everyone agrees, but basically nobody really wants to do much about it. I think that's the priority or the lack of priority that we're wrestling with.
When you say sort of resistance, is it kind of active or passive, do you think?
Oh, I think it would make Gandhi proud. It's very passive. It's very right. Like, no, all sympathy. Yeah, absolutely, you know. I think it's probably, in many cases, you know, it's genuine. You know, people do think it's good, but there is a perception amongst at least some significant stakeholders that, and I've had this put to me directly, you know, there's no votes in cannabis, and there is risk, and risk is something that obviously governments are very averse to unless there's a strong reward, and if their perception is that there's no votes in it, then that's the problem. And for us, it's extremely difficult because if you look at any number of indicators, clearly there's enormous community support for reform. So to say, therefore, that ipso facto there is no votes in it, it's totally counterintuitive to my mind, but apparently not in the minds of many of the politicians in the Labor governments that we're dealing with.
And it's interesting because I think, you know, so far, the approach has been, you know, to try and persuade and collaborate and work with the government. Recently, you and your colleague in Victoria, Rachel Payne, threatened to withdraw support for Labor on key policy issues after another heavy police presence and dozens of arrests at a 420 event in Melbourne. What sort of response do you get to that approach?
That was only a couple of weeks ago, so I think it's a bit early to gauge. And I don't think we've done anything particularly unpleasant to the government yet. So we have said to the government, you know, we want to meet with the Premier. We want to talk to a senior figure who's actually got authority to talk about the changes that are to be made. And there's been a lot of flip-flopping around on that. And that does annoy us because there's a number of members of the crossbench who never vote with the government. Other than on the rarest occasions, and they've had meetings with the Premier to discuss their priorities. This Premier has been in power now for over 6 months, you know, in a leadership position, and we can't get a meeting with her to talk about things. So, you know, we don't necessarily particularly want to kick the government, you know, for the sake of kicking the government, but it's just out of sheer frustration that we're treated nicely, but, you know, there's not the changes that we want happening. That's sort of where we're at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because as you say, your votes can be crucial in helping bills or motions get across the line. So you've clearly got some leverage. What was it about this particular moment that kind of meant that you'd sort of use that leverage or threatened to? Was it kind of just the tipping point or...
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, and I suppose coming back from Mardi Gras, it doubly reinforces it. It's like, just stop bloody well arresting armed people, you know? Like, you know, they talk about this being a victimless crime, you know, cannabis, da-da-da-da. Well, you know, if it's a victimless, if there are victims here, the victims are the sort of 9 to 10,000 Victorians who get arrested every year for simple possession. Not commercial, nothing commercial, you know? Just having cannabis. And at 420, you know, I guess apart from the fact that probably the sight of 60 police and assorted dogs and whatever else scared off probably three quarters of the crowd, you know, the fact of the matter is we had to go through that intimidation of having, you know, groups of four or five officers with a dog searching, sniffing people, searching people at random as they went through the crowd. And this went on consistently for... 4 hours, 5 hours. And the government says, oh, you know, but no one was actually arrested. You had 36 people cautioned and four people summoned, you know, as though that's normal. It's like, oh, you should just accept this because, you know, that's just the way the world is. Well, it's not. You know, supposedly, you know, they love to pat themselves on the back and go, you know, we're Australia's most progressive state. Well, we were the only place in Australia, the only place in Australia where we had that level of police harassment and intimidation, and it is intimidating, and it's not good enough. And I would have to say, Martin, in terms of the actual officers who were there, I mean, it was really interesting. I mean, we had, unlike last year, we were able to actually negotiate with the government, or with the police command to cover Medcan. So we actually had, prior to the rally, protocols in place for how to deal with people with medicinal cannabis, and if they had their dispensing canister and their ID, the police just moved on. So that was good. And we were very proactive. We had, you know, a lot of legal observers there and stuff like that, so that sort of helped.
Oh, good.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is it was still deeply intimidating. For what? For what?
And in terms of, you know, where do you place responsibility for that? Because I read someone that you said that actually the police presence was less heavy-handed than in previous years. But nevertheless, what you've just described, as you say, is people being intimidated and arrested, etc. Should the police have more discretion on how they manage those events, or do you blame the government?
I think the role that the police commissioner played was very interesting, you know, because the police commissioner came out early and basically said, we will be adopting the zero tolerance. You know, and we're saying to the government, look, you know, you need to back off. You need to back off. And the police commissioner didn't back off. But the police commissioner also said, my job is to enforce the law, not to make it. So you, the government, effectively this is what he's saying, you know, you, the government, if you don't want this to be treated as an offence, change the law. Don't, though, leave this statute on the books and tell me to ignore it. A, you don't have the legal ability to do it, but B, you know, if the law's wrong, change the law. Mm. And so in that sense, even though he might have been our chief tormentor, there's actually quite a lot of sympathy for the position that Shane Patton put forward as the chief commissioner to actually make the reforms. And you look at the cops, you know, who were there, you know, and I am getting old and the cops look like they're getting younger, but, you know, you could see most of them were, like, really embarrassed. You know, there was a few dicks, but most, you know, overwhelmingly, they were very professional, very polite. Mm. They were doing what they were instructed to do, but they looked overwhelmingly embarrassed that there was this hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of staffing being deployed for people who were obviously just there to have a picnic, you know, and have a chuff and get on with it. And the other one that was a very interesting moment, I think, was actually at the countdown time, 4:20, when there was a couple of us on stage who decided we were going to spark up along with the crowd. And in the minutes before the 4:20 countdown, we could see the senior officers indicating to all the patrolling cops, you know, pull back, pull back. So by the time 420 actually came and we did spark up, there were no police within physical distance to actually arrest us or to charge us or to do anything whatsoever. They literally pulled back so there couldn't be that confrontation. And then 20 minutes later, they resumed their patrol through the crowd. So, you know, there was a level of strategy and about it. And you know, some people I've spoken to have said, well, you know, that's a really positive sign. 2 years ago, they were riding horses into the crowds. Last year, we were seeing Medcan patients being cable tied. There was lots of arrests and there was a very high level of physical intimidation. This time it was much more low-key and obviously there was a sort of more structured approach to how to confront it. So whether that's good or not, I don't know, but I guess there's some progress there.
Now, I can sense your frustration and you describe the relationship, I think, between... Well, is that the cops coming to get you now?
Oh, my God! They're here, Martin! Help!
We couldn't have timed that better. So you kind of, I think, described the relationship between yourself and Rachel and the government as kind of reaching an all-time low. And I think you meant, you know, it's been difficult to get a meeting. Do you feel like they kind of take you for granted a little bit in terms of, you know, where you might vote with them? And is that something that, obviously you haven't had a response from them yet, but do you feel a little bit as if they're kind of, it's taken as read that you're going to support them?
I think that might be something. The position we put to the minders, you know, to the there's a significant army around the Premier, is that, look, it's really up to you. It's up to you, the government, to define the relationship. You know, we're not here to cut your lunch. You know exactly what we want. We're perfectly happy. And you won't hear this very often from politicians, but we are perfectly happy to be made redundant. Because all you got to do is pass a couple of pieces of legislation, we'll get out of your hair. You know, job's done. It's not that hard. It's not that complex.
Yep.
So it's up to them. You know, the ball's in their court. If their position is one of, well, we're not going to do anything, we're just going to filibuster, then obviously that inevitably means we either put up or we shut up. Again, it's entirely up to the government. If they want to turn us into a purely oppositional party, they can do that. And certainly to anyone who understands the political base of Legalised Cannabis Australia, one of the things that's very unique about our party is that we draw very broadly from across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
So when we made that threat to the government that we would no longer be automatically supporting, you know, that support was no longer our default setting, Rachel and I were inundated, literally inundated with members basically going, it's about bloody time. You know, good on you. You were too nice to them anyway. You know, so in terms of our personal popularity within the party, and I think clearly within a lot of the voters in the two areas where we are, and we're in pretty strong working class and multicultural areas, the overwhelming public and party feedback was extremely positive to get more bullish with the government.
You're right. Okay.
I don't particularly necessarily want to go oppositional, but if that's what the government wants us to do, well, yeah, fine, let's get into it.
You know, we mentioned obviously Mardi Gras at the top of the podcast. How was the police presence in Nimbin over the weekend?
Non-existent within the town, and random drug testing on all the major roads in and out.
Right. So the usual then.
And look, I mean, it was sort of like a sort of a cannabis Soviet, you know, in terms of within the township, because it was you could literally not see any cops. There was I can't even remember seeing a vehicle in the police station, which is right in the middle of town.
Right.
But yeah, there was reports of all of the major roads in and out of Nimbin had random drug testing, and of course that's one of the big issues. You know, one of the big issues that we're trying to deal with is this whole question of random drug testing, how we deal with that. And obviously we've got a related one happening down here, which is the workplace drug testing, which will raise very similar issues.
Yeah, I want to get an update on that before we finish. But just sticking with Mardi Gras for a second, I think I'm right in saying that all five legalised cannabis MPs were there. I know Sophia was there. I think Brian was there from WA, and obviously yourself and Rachel and Jeremy. Mm-hmm. Do you use those kind of opportunities to get together and kind of carve out joint positions on topics, whether kind of, you know, cannabis related or otherwise, or do you largely sort of run your own races in the different states?
I like your use of the expression joint positions there. That was very, 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 very subtle, Martin.
And completely accidental as well.
It's fantastic. As an opportunity to sort of kick back, find some relaxing substances and then just sort of brainstorm. And talk about, you know, what works, what doesn't work. Yeah, it's fabulous. It actually, we didn't have enough time to do the sort of conversations we wanted to, and I think that's something we've learned from. We actually need to spend more time comparing notes. That said, you know, we're all in different positions. So in a way, I guess probably Rachel and I are sort of ahead of the pack to some degree. The West Australians have obviously got a problem, which is that the government doesn't need them. And doesn't give a rat's ass about it, as far as I can tell, in WA. Jeremy in New South Wales is sort of hot on our heels, so he's doing a lot of the things that Fiona Patten had previously done, or we did when we first started. They've got an inquiry coming up into cannabis, and that will be in the lead up to the drug summit. But I'm sure you'll probably get a chance to talk to him well before that moves on. We're a bit further downstream. You know, we've obviously already moved a personal use bill. We've already moved a bill on random drug testing for drivers and Medcan. We've got next week a new hemp industry bill. Yes, it's next week. Phew. Still recovering from Mardi Gras. I just had a minor panic attack for a minute there. We're not debating it in the House tomorrow. It's next week. But yes, there's certainly that whole, you know, we're that further down the road. And so to sort of compare notes, what worked, what didn't, you know, where are you getting traction? Where are you really hitting the hard spots? Yeah, it's a great opportunity.
And in terms of, you mentioned the inquiry in New South Wales, and obviously Brian's chaired the select committee into cannabis and hemp in WA. Is that a kind of path that you and Rachel might go down, getting an inquiry?
Or? No, on the contrary, actually. I mean, we sort of have a position, there's been more than enough inquiries.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, because that's sort of the default setting for governments that want to filibuster is, oh, let's set up a whatever. That said, we are supportive of some further research and consultation in a particular context. So I might just explain where we're up to in terms of our current demand on government. And what we're saying is, in terms of personal use in particular, we can take the whole question of recreational adult use cannabis into two parts, demand and supply. In terms of the demand element, we're saying the personal use bill that we've pushed up, which we're calling ACT Plus, just do it. Just do it. It's not complex. You know, you need to concurrently put up an appropriate, you know, public health and education program. But basically, legislatively, it's not highly problematic. It's a law that everyone's flaunting. You've got a $1.2 billion minimum criminal market on recreational use. Just make the changes. There's no need for further inquiries. Yes, there needs to be some consideration of the education and health promotion elements, from which the government is at the moment entirely marginalised, because it's you know, like, just say no. You know, I mean, if ever you want an invitation to young people to get into it, tell them no. You know, to have the government say, don't do this. You know, so there's opportunity for the government there to actually make real gains through legalisation, through like an ACT Plus mechanism. On the question of commercialisation, we recognise that there actually doesn't need to be a process. And we said to government, we'd like to see an expert advisory panel established. And that expert advisory panel would really look at, you know, if we've got 30 or 40 different examples from abroad as to what a commercialised cannabis market looks like, you know, let's actually take a bit of time to think about what's going to work here. You know, what's going to be effective? You know, we go the Canadian model, do we go the New York model, do we go the, you know, the Spanish model or the Maltese model? Or, you know, there's any number of them, and the answer is probably all of them and none of them. You know, take the best, reject the rest. You know, that sort of an approach. So there would be that. So an immediate legalization, followed by a period of community consultation and research to actually come up with the a commercial market setting. And that's sort of what we're advocating at the moment.
And have you put that to them directly at this point? Or?
Oh, I've got it all on two pages. yes.
If only you could get a meeting.
Exactly. And look, I mean, there's lots of people that have seen the document. No one's disagreeing with the document. I mean, we've got one, you know, one page is just like, here's a set of facts, you know, 80% use it. 750,000 Victorians used cannabis in the last 12 months. And that's not counting medicinal, you know, or purely medicinal. And this is using the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare data, which is very fresh. And it's a huge sample group. Yeah, so 22,500 sample groups. So it's like 10 times your typical national poll. The data's all there. So we explain that. And then it's look here. Stage one, ACT plus, legalize it. Stage two, expert advisory panel, and then move into a commercialized model.
Now, you mentioned about inquiries and, you know, that can be an excuse to kick the can down the road. Obviously, where there is an inquiry at the moment is the drug testing, the workplace drug testing inquiry in Victoria, which I think the committee is due to report by the end of June. Where do you see that going next?
Well, you've got me worried. I think the report back date's a bit later than that, but we've got public hearings May 22 and 23. So for those people who want to tune into Victorian parliamentary TV, you can join the other four people watching the show. But yes, there'll be a range of evidence provided. It's sort of got two prongs to the inquiry. One is, I guess, looking specifically at that whole industrial framework. So in terms of what people are exposed to at the workplace level, it's one of, inappropriate practices, stigmatisation, marginalisation, victimisation of our people, you know, of our community, of consumers. There's no shortage of anecdotes, and this will be reflected in the committee's testimony, to people just outrageous, you know, just outrageous, going to their employer saying, I'm on medicinal cannabis, and the next thing they know, they're on performance management, or, you know, their career's dead in the water, or they're being encouraged to leave. And these are not people that are operating machinery or high risk. Mm. These are people who just come clean on the fact that they've got a medical script for cannabis. That's it. So one will be actually looking at those practices and what is an appropriate protection, what is good practice, because the Victorian legislation is not particularly good in terms of that. The second one is really opening up the question of how do we understand the nature and the level of the discrimination. So we will be very actively exploring this question of, does your use of prescription medication fall within the definition of disability within the Human Rights Act? And can we operationalise that? And or do we need to get amendment to the Act to cover that so that it would actually become an offence to discriminate against someone because they're on medication?
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, like if there's impairment, you know, we're not seeking to defend impairment. You know, we're not seeking to defend risk taking, but what we're saying is that the law has failed to keep pace, not only with cannabis, medical cannabis, but it's failed to keep track with whole area of workplace based impairment and assessment of that impairment and ensuring that work is safe for everyone. So there's some pretty meaty stuff, and as you could imagine, at the heart of this again, we come back to exactly the same hoary old problem we've got with medicinal cannabis driving, which is this question of impairment versus presence of THC.
I was going to ask you about that. So last we heard, there was going to be an off-road driving trial. Is that even started yet? Where's that up to?
My understanding is there'll be an announcement later today. we're recording this on
wow.
Tuesday.
It's only May.
So our understanding is that the tender has been let for the research, and that'll be being confirmed in the budget today.
Okay.
And yes, we're expecting that to sort of take 6 to 8 weeks, sort of for the on-track trial and the evaluation, and then they'll go into data analysis mode and such like. So we would be reasonably confident that this will come to a head by the sort of end of the calendar year, in terms of the research has been done, the findings have been documented, peer reviewed, da 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 da, and then we'll be into the, well, you know, what do you do with it? And I guess this is where, again, we've got some level of scepticism because, you know, I mean, the major thing that's unique about it is that it's on a racetrack. You've already had in the Netherlands, you know, on real roads. We pretty much, I think, pretty much know exactly what's going to come out of it. Might be proven wrong, but you know, I think that's the case. So really it's then, okay, well, if you know that after medication, you're going to have a window of impairment, and it's going to vary with the person, and it's going to vary with the nature of ingestion or versus inhalation and such like. Now, what are you going to do about that? The government's not particularly keen to talk about that at this stage. So watch this space. We'll have something to talk about later in the year, Martin.
But you're confident that it will at least be done by the end of 2024, one way or the other?
Absolutely. Will the argument still be going? Quite possibly. but in terms of the actual research itself, I would anticipate that, that would be over by, third quarter this year, by the end of September. They should have all of the trials should be finished and done and dusted. And so it'll really be a question of, collating the findings. There is some other research that's being undertaken as part of this project that's looking at what other jurisdictions are doing in terms of this. They'll want to figure out what's happening elsewhere. But, this will all come to a head, I would envisage, by the end of the year, and I would hope that we're in serious negotiation if we're still talking with the government.
I'd like to thank you for that little nugget because, you heard it here first, and I can go back to Jonesy and tell him I've scooped him. So that's always
he's
nice.
He's going to be disappointed.
He will. Serves him right for not being here. Thanks, David. Just before we wrap up, a quick reminder that tickets for the Cannabis Awards 2024 are now on sale. Not only are they on sale, but they're actually selling out fast. So if you don't want to miss out, please do get in quick and jump on the website and buy your tickets. And after that blatant plug, it just leaves me to thank David for joining us again.
Thank you, Martin. It's always a pleasure. Look forward to talking again soon.
And we'll see you next time on the Cannabis Podcast.
Bye, folks.